often a kid who's very often very smart, and they get to school, and books can very easily come to feel like something boring or something even worse that makes them feel stupid. You know, and how can you love something that makes you feel stupid even though you're clever as anything?
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. That was the Waterstones Children's Laureate, Cressida Cowell, who's my guest today. You'll already be very familiar with her name if you've got kids or nieces and nephews, as I have. She is the author and illustrator behind the best-selling The Wizards of Want series and the How to Train Your Dragon series. The latter also became a very successful DreamWorks franchise. She's also the author of the Emily Brown picture books, which are illustrated by Neil Layton. I spoke to Cressida in January. She'd just taken delivery of a puppy and was trying to get it settled in with her older dog. So it was quite an exciting day, I think. And she was in her writing shed at the bottom of her London garden. She lives right next to a park, and she said during the summer in her writing shed, she is entirely surrounded by green, looking out on roses and a magnolia tree. I think that sums up the vibe really of this interview, because Cressida is such a joyful, glass half full, optimistic person to talk to, and that really shone through in everything she had to say about writing. As the Children's Laureate, she also has a very ambitious charter of things she wants to achieve, and she's very passionate about getting children into reading for pleasure. We talked about that, as well as the world building she does in her books and how her blend of writing and illustration draws in young readers. So, over to Cressida.
The only problem with this view is that because I love my garden, even though I never know what I'm doing, but it's very tempting to go out and say, oh, you know, that rose needs a bit of a seeing to, or, you know, oh, I should do a bit of weeding there when you're supposed to be concentrating on the writing. But it is, it's very, I've also found it very good for, we built the writing ship and I just had a baby, because I started writing literally when I just was about to have my first child, kind of 23 years ago, Hattie.
Gosh.
I can't believe it. It feels like yesterday. And so the shed was really important back then as a sort of separation, because you know how it is when you've got little babies and toddlers and you're just completely absorbed into them, aren't you? Mm. And so having a working space that was even just that, I mean, it, you know, of course they could toddle down the garden and there I was, but it was a sort of separation into a different space. And I think that's so important. And I think that's probably why there are so many writing sheds. And we all know about Roald Dahl. You know, everybody knows about Roald Dahl. But actually, there was loads of writers write in writing sheds, you discover nowadays. And I can't remember, there was a very famous writer, and I'm now not going to be able to remember who it was, who had a revolving writing shed.
Oh gosh, that's very fancy.
Who was that? I should look that up. Yeah, which said revolved to catch the sun.
Was it
the guy who wrote Pygmalion? I'm probably making it up.
But
I'm not about the revolving writing shed. Yes, if you Google it. And I think there's so many writers who do that for that very reason, is that you have to go into your own imaginary world, and having that space that's out of your normal life is really helpful for that.
Yes. And what about inside your writing shed? What have you got in there, and what are you sort of looking at? What's your view as you sit at your desk? Are you looking out onto the garden, or are you looking at a wall?
Oh no, I have windows on all the sides where there could be windows.
Okay.
So on two sides, it's all windows and French windows. So it's very light, and there's even a window in the ceiling, because I illustrate my books as well. So it's really important, the light. So I'm absolutely looking out on garden all the time. And then there's a geranium inside, half inside and half out. I shall open up the window every now and then so it gets a bit of sun. And there's lots of photographs of the places that inspire me and the people that inspire me. So there's lots of my children and my father, my parents, and my grandfather. I'm just looking at, here I am, and my husband, and lots of photos of the places that inspired How to Train Your Dragon and Wizards of Once. So of the island, there's a real Scottish island that inspired How to Train Your Dragon. There's masses of photos of that. And maps. It's quite a small space, Hattie. I often say to children that you don't need a big space. I mean, it really is quite small, but it's packed with pencils and photos and maps. There's a lot of maps of my world. Mm. I draw the maps because a map is a fantastic way of making an imaginary place feel like a real place. And so if you look at, there's a very famous quote about Treasure Island. The guy who wrote Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson, said before he thought of the idea for the story, he drew the map. And as he drew the map, the pirates came creeping out of the map at him.
Oh, gosh.
John Silver, his cutlass between his teeth. Yeah. And so the act of drawing the map gave him the idea for the story. And it also makes that imaginary place feel real because you're treating it like it really is real. Mm. So if I turn to my left, just a smidgen, I can see the map of the Wizard Wildwoods. And because I've drawn it out, I can know exactly how long it takes to get from Wish's house, well, the castle where she lives to where Zar lives. I know how long because I've made the map of it.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing way of making an imaginary place feel like a real place. And then if I turn my head just very slightly more to the left, I've got towers of books. And so one of those books will be Treasure Island. I've always got Treasure Island within an arm's breadth distance. I've always got a thesaurus, a Shakespeare, complete works of Shakespeare, lots of books on nature and woods and the childhood books that inspired me.
Are you writing a book at the moment?
I am. And I forgot to mention one of the other things that I have with it, also there's pencils and pens and... because I'm an illustrator, that's a way in for me.
Yeah.
But there's also a suitcase, a very old battered suitcase filled with writing equipment and letters and things. And that's there because I always think that it's to remind me that when you're writing a book, it's going on a journey. And when you're writing a new book, which I am, you're going on a journey into unknown territory, which is always simultaneously exciting and rather terrifying.
That's very exciting. Are you creating a whole new world for this book?
A whole new world.
Gosh.
Which actually, Hattie, I haven't done that often because Wizards of Once was... I mean, How to Train Your Dragon, the first one was 2003, was it? Oh my goodness, yes, it was 2003. And then I was writing those for nearly 14, 15 years, something like that. So The Wizards Once came out about 4 or 5 years ago, and that was the first time I'd written a new series. How to Train Your Dragon was the first work of fiction that I'd ever written. And so this is only the second time I've done this, I remind myself.
Yes.
when I feel a little bit overwhelmed by the whole thing. Because when you know what your world is and you've got your map and you've got your characters and you know your themes and... you found where you are, it's much easier than creating a whole world from scratch.
I'm sure it must be. So when you're doing what you're doing at the moment, what's your sort of routine with it? What are you doing every day when you sit down to start work? Or is it every day?
Well, for me, it's always had to be every day because of the way that I started. I mean, I had quite limited time. So when I had my first book published, which was a picture book, actually, because I went to art school as well as university. I read English and then I went at university and then went to art school. So it was a picture book. But I had 2 days a week childcare, a very small baby, had a lot to do, you know. So I, right from then, I got in the habit of, when I had the time, of just having to do it. And actually, that's a really good routine to have, a really good discipline to have, because it's always going to be, I mean, we all know, anybody who's a writer knows it's emotional stuff, writing. You know, it can be frustrating, and one minute you can think, I'm a genius. the next minute you can think, I'm an idiot. You know, and the swing between that is quite a quick one, and that makes it very sort of emotional. You're getting a lot of, and if you're writing stuff that is going to resonate with other people, it can be funny and dramatic and exciting, but it has to be meaningful, I think. And so you're taking a lot out of yourself. So the temptation to put things off or to continually sort of revise is a very strong one. So I think it's been a real advantage to sort of have to get in there and to have always had an impossible deadline, which I always did. And I never had enough time. and I might not have realised it then. I'm looking back to the, you know, to oh my goodness, 1, 2, 3 small babies and the deadlines. It was stressy, but there were some advantages to it. Is that I had to do it.
Yes, you had to hit the ground running every day.
Yeah. So I always am in the shed if I can be, if I'm not doing publicity, or at 8. 8 is really, you know, time for a good breakfast. I always need a good breakfast. And get in the shed and start working.
And how long are you there for from 8?
Well, it does depend on what the day holds. So it does depend on whether there is publicity stuff. But I try to do that in blocks. So I'll do that if I can, you know, in a block. And not hopefully in the mornings, because the mornings is the time when I work most effectively. People are so different about that. Obviously, if I have a deadline, so what I'm saying is I'll be in there till lunchtime, and then I never miss a meal, Hattie.
I'm glad to hear it. Neither do I.
A meal. So I'm back inside for lunch. But if I've got a deadline, I'll be flat out in the shed. And I'll be late at night, and I work a lot of weekends, even if I haven't got a deadline. But but I try not to do that. I'm not as happy working in the evenings as I am in the morning. I have to confess, I'm a morning person. Mm-hmm. I know there's lots of people who like working in the evening and who find they get the most inspiration then. But I find that's generally when I'm right up against the wire.
Yes.
When there's no way out.
Let's go back a little bit and talk about your childhood, because I've read that you had this very interesting childhood where you spent a lot of time on a small Scottish island. Would you describe that a little bit and talk about how it influenced your interest in stories, if indeed it did?
Oh, it absolutely did. I mean, I had a split childhood in that my father's job was in London. So that's where, you know, that was where the bulk of my time was, in London, in a house without a garden, which also had its own influences on it. If you grew up in a house without a garden, you know, you read a lot. Reading is an escape there, so that had an effect. But the thing that really, really inspired me was my dad. Although his job was in London, his heart was in the wilderness. He was an environmentalist. And so he was chairman of the RSPB for many years, Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. He was a big ornithologist. And after he retired, he was chairman of Kew Gardens. And a passionate, lifelong environmentalist. But what that meant for us as children was that his heart was in the wilderness. Every year from when I was a baby, we would be taken to this uninhabited island off the west coast of Scotland. an island so small that when you stood on the top of it, you could see sea all around you. Wow. And there was nothing on the island. No houses, no roads, no phones, no mobile phone connection back in the 1970s. Absolutely no way of contacting the outside world if something went wrong. And we'd be dropped off by a local boatman. This is when we were very tiny. And then picked up again 2 weeks later. I mean, imagine with three small children. I mean, they were crazy. I don't know what they were thinking. Now a parent myself.
Yes, but weren't they frightened? What if one of you had fallen out of a tree or something?
Well, there weren't any trees. Too blowy for trees. Too windy. Too windy out in the middle of the in the Hebrides for trees. But on that particular little island. In fact, my dad spent his whole life. He's just about. He died fairly recently.
I'm sorry.
My darling dad. He just about had got some trees growing in some dips. But he did take sort of 40 years trying to grow the trees. But yes, it was an incredible experience for a child to be. I don't know, but I think I had a sense even then. My goodness, these guys are crazy. Because I was a more cautious person. I mean, I put quite a lot of myself into Hiccup and Hiccup's relationship with Stoic. Because Stoic, you know, is afraid of nothing and dauntless, and that was my dad, and I think I did all the worrying for them. I mean, they just didn't worry half enough, I thought. And then from when I was nine, my dad got a boat, and then we'd go out to sea to catch fish to eat, because then we spent the whole summer on the island.
Wow.
I think back in the 1970s you could get away with that, you know, even if you had a job, you wouldn't be able to do that nowadays. But yeah, we spent the whole summer up there, and then my dad got a boat to catch fish to eat. So we go out in storms, and because there was no supermarket and the house had no electricity. So that's the other thing. I go in, I tell children that, I say, whole summer on an island with no television. the children, you can hear the
awful
intake of breath. Yeah. So we read a lot, and I was the eldest, and so even of the cousins as well who came to stay. So I was in charge of the entertainment of all the kids, because back in the 1970s, A, you weren't supervised. Anybody knows that who grew up then, you know, wherever you were, they just say, oh, come back in time for lunch. You go off and... Oh, I mean, looking back, we'd go out in rubber dinghies on our own and things like that.
Wow.
Unbelievable, I know, with no life jackets and things. And I was in charge of these smaller siblings and entertaining them. And I read them stories and made up plays. And then that part of Scotland, so you can just hear from Hans talking how much of an inspiration it was and how much came from that experience.
Yes.
Because that part of Scotland was the first part of the British Isles that the Vikings came to when they invaded, and it was the last place they left. So Vikings really did live on those islands long ago. I mean, and they came as pirates and they stayed to settle. So a lot of the stories from the islands that my dad used to read aloud to us by firelight, I mean, it all sounds like I'm making it up, but it's true, I promise you, were about Vikings, or were stories, Viking tales. And Vikings believed that dragons really existed. So that's the direct, you know, that's where I got the ideas from, because back when I was a little girl, you know, we were on this island after dark. It really did feel like a place where a dragon might live in a cave.
Yes. Thanks to your parents, you had already lived quite a lot of adventures before you even reached adulthood.
I know.
I mean, what a gift to give you.
I know, but I think, and I mean, that was very extreme, but actually, I mean, in staying with my grandparents, you know, on their farm, you know, the children just, we just ran wild a bit. We were sort of unsupervised. And that is a bit of a gift. And I'm not sure how we recreate that for our children. because we sort of lost something, haven't we?
Yeah.
We can't do that.
When do you remember becoming a writer? When did you start writing, and how did it, talk me through how it developed into a career for you? Of course, you're a writer and illustrator. I don't want to forget the illustration as well. So yes, tell me about how that came about.
Yes, and that's a really important part. The illustrating is a really important part of my whole writing. I write and illustrate almost simultaneously. So yes, that is very important. I'm so glad you picked up on that. I got to look back to that time as a child, because as I said, I was head of the entertainment section, but I was also a big reader, and that was partly from because there was no telly on the island and it rains a lot in Scotland but it was also because there was no garden in London, and we went to the library every week, again like a lot of children in the 1970s, and so I read a lot, and then I was reading aloud to the younger siblings and the younger cousins. And I remember there was one particular book that I had loved called The Ogre Downstairs. And it's about some children who find a magical chemistry set, and each of the different chemicals does a different thing. Oh, I loved that book. It made me laugh. And I read it aloud to the younger ones. I just remember them saying, "Oh, please read one more chapter," and just laughing so, and it was such a great feeling, that feeling. And I think even back then when I was 9, I thought, wow, this is so wonderful. I want to do this, because I love books so much. I want to be able to write books that can make children say, "Oh, one more chapter and be as excited about books as I am. So that was a very early start, really, wasn't it?
Mm.
I wouldn't have thought it consciously. It was just, I knew that was something that I wanted to do. And also I wrote plays with them. And I remember kind of, you know, giving everybody a different role. And when I was very little, I was quite bossy. so I would be a lot of the big roles, and the director and the stage designer, and that's almost still what I'm doing, isn't it? I'm doing my own stage designs with the maps and directing it, and you know, so it all started the wanting to do it, I think, very little. But I was not very neat or very tidy, and I wasn't very good at following rules as a little kid, and so I was often in trouble at school. I tell that a lot to children, because I wasn't sort of disobedient, but I just found it hard to do things in the right way, and so I was in trouble a lot. And that's why I write about children who are in trouble a lot, because I think that can be very difficult for children. And I think they empathise, you know, they can understand that you know, sometimes children think they have to do things in the right kind of way. And they think they can't be a writer because they're not getting, you know, top marks in English, or they can compare themselves to other people all the time. But I was quite a late developer, so I try and say that to children, because I think a lot of, you know, bright, imaginative children are put off because they're dyslexic or something like that. But later on, I was a late developer. But then I ended up going to Oxford to read English, which I would not have expected as a smaller child. And that was a big. That was a big influence. Being able to, Oxford was very old-fashioned in its course. I look at my daughter's course now. She's reading English extra, and it's, you could do creative writing, and you could study film. And Oxford wasn't like that back then. But I would have loved that. But I did love learning Anglo-Saxon. I know,
kind
of very old-fashioned thing, and because of course there was all that, you know, the Norse sagas and things like that, and the all of that poetry and that very bittersweet Anglo-Saxon poetry, and that that's found its way into what I'm doing now. And I think studying English gives you a real feel for the way, different ways that people write stories. So that was really important in becoming a writer for me.
And then you went to art school after that.
And then I went to art school. So I was a long time in education. And I often sort of wonder which bit of it I could have missed out, because it did take me a very long time. And that could get demoralising sometimes, because even as a young adult, I mean, I know children compare themselves to others, but even young adults, you do. And you look at all your friends and they're all getting on with their careers and everything. And I felt I was being left behind rather in my 20s. But I knew I had to be doing what I was doing. And indeed, I use every single bit of my education and everything I do now. Because the art is, my books are young fiction, but they're heavily illustrated. And the art is a real intrinsic part of the work. I think when I started writing How To, I felt I was writing something that there was a bit of a gap for. I was writing for a smart kid, a bright kid, because children are bright, and that's actually all kids. All kids are bright and are much smarter than we give them credit for, highly intelligent. But a kid who maybe wasn't enjoying reading yet, and for whom the visuals would be a real way in. So my books never dumb down, and indeed they're pretty challenging, although they don't look like it, because yes. I make them laugh and I make the characters they care about the characters, but actually they're quite demanding. The vocabularies and the ideas are actually quite sophisticated, but they don't realise it. And a big part of that is the illustration.
How did your first book come about? Did you just decide it was what you wanted to do and write it and then start looking for a publisher, or did somebody approach you? Or?
Yeah, this is such a good question, because how you make that first leap from education into the working world is a really tricky one for writers. And there's a certain amount of luck involved, I have to say. A huge amount, I think, as well as perseverance and endurance and all of those kind of things. For me, it was actually my first book I wrote on the Brighton MA in narrative illustration. Mm-hmm. So it was a picture book called Bo Peep's Library Book. And I wrote it on the MA, so I had all the input from lovely John Vernon Lord, and these are my tutors there, amazing tutors on that course, incredible. George Hardy, Chris Mullen, great tradition at Brighton of great illustrators. Raymond Briggs taught there, and Chris Riddell was also taught at Brighton. I mean, he was taught by other people at Brighton. I think he was taught by Raymond Briggs. I was very lucky to have their input. And what then happened was, in fact, yes, I entered a prize while I was on that course, the MA at Brighton, called the Macmillan Children's Book Prize. And although I didn't win the competition, I met an editor, who that was really important, and that was how I made my first steps into the world. And that's in fact why Hachette Books has started a prize called the Carmelite Prize, where an established author writes a picture book text, and if you win it as a student, you get that book published. And I wrote the very first picture book text for that prize, precisely because that reason, because I think it's so hard to get that first book contract, and it was a bit of a way of saying thank you, I suppose, for what has happened to me with the Macmillan Children's Book Prize.
Yeah,
it's tricky. It's tricky getting that first contract. I mean, it's always tricky. I mean, this is not an easy. I've been talking to lots of, you know, wannabe writers and potential, you know, and we all know, or people who are writing already, and we all know that it's not an easy life. but getting that first contract is a tricky one.
And let's go back a little bit to the sort of blend between the writing and the illustration, because I'm just looking at some of your books today, and you're right that, I don't know, if you pick it up, they're quite chunky novels, and you might think, oh, this is going to be too hard for my child or whatever. And then as you open them up, you've got such a great combination of writing and these very sort of vivid, imaginative illustrations, and often bits of text almost worked into the illustrations. So they feel immediately much more accessible as soon as you open, you know.
Yeah.
So I wondered, you said that the words and the illustrations sort of come almost simultaneously. Are you literally moving between typing and drawing while you're working on a book, or is it a bit more structured than that?
At the beginning, yes, I am, really. I mean, you know, the words are more predominant. I mean, probably, you know, just because there's more of them, I guess. But if I'm kind of in a new location, or I will draw out that location. And if I'm creating a new character, drawing out the character before I even write it is a good way in, because also drawing is a very good way of channeling your unconscious brain. I like the unconscious brain. so the unconscious brain can lead you into the heart of something in a way sometimes, that if you're just writing, it doesn't allow you to do that. I mean, the illustration is so so important. You really put your finger on it when you said that about how it makes it feel child friendly, because that's the, it's everything. So it's not just the illustration, it's also I put things, a lot of capitals, I put in a lot of different font weights and different fonts, and this is all to make the book feel like a lively object. Because often a kid who's very often very smart, and they get to school, and you know, writing and books can very easily come to make to feel like something boring, or something even worse that makes them feel stupid, you know. And how can you love something that makes you feel stupid, even though you're clever as anything, you know? But films and telly gets beamed in magically to children's heads, and it's often very sophisticated films and telly, but something they've got to struggle at, like a book, can very easily come to represent something boring, and or something, as I say, that makes them feel stupid. So I'm trying to overturn that all the time with making the fonts very exciting, and cutting through the wodges of text with wild illustrations and ink blots and child-friendly, scrawly illustrations. And that's a really important part of it. But also, I suppose, because it's using the accident as well. There's a reason that hiccup is called hiccup, an accident. But it's mixed up also, particularly with the later ones, because the work develops in Wizards of Once. There's a lot more world building illustration. So there's a mixture there. There's the scrawly illustrations that do the mark making and kind of pull you through the story in a wild way. They're very emotional. Lots of weather, and lots of energy strokes, and this sort of mirrors the energetic, slightly manic, out of control plot lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that energy. But then particularly in the later books, there's a lot of more world-building illustrations, which, you know, so the snow cats really do feel like something the child could climb on top of, and, you know, the world. So the illustrations are all doing different things, or I mean, it's all like a piece of music, really. I think of it like a piece of music. So if you're conducting a piece of music, you have some, you have refrains through it, don't you? So I have a manic energy refrain, getting through the plot, and then that's that kind of, you know, whizzy illustration. And then you have more tender moments, because sometimes my books are trying to be tender or emotional or thoughtful, and that will have a very thoughtful sort of tender line to the illustration. Mm. And that's how I think of writing, really, in words and pictures, is it's like conducting a piece of music.
That's lovely. That's a lovely way to think of it. You're very prolific, Cressida, and I mean, I had a look at your, I lost count of how many books you've published. It's well over 20. Do you know how many it is?
Not quite sure, actually. It's of the fiction, it's 12 How to Train Your Dragons, 4 Wizards of Once's, and this new one that I'm just working on right now. But then I have written picture books, Emily Brown, 4 of them. Oh my goodness, yes, it's a lot.
I mean, you talked earlier about having to fit work in where you could and having 3 children, and I wondered if life has ever gotten in the way, because it feels like it hasn't, nothing has slowed you down, or that's how it looks from the outside.
Yes, isn't it funny? Because it isn't quite how it feels like on the inside.
No.
maybe, I mean, I am an energetic person, and I think it's interesting. Maybe it was because I also started very late. I felt I had quite a lot to prove. Okay, I felt I had quite a lot to prove, because I was starting quite late, because also trying to do it with the children was, when they were little in particular, I mean, because at the beginning I wasn't really making enough to pay for the childcare, you know, I mean, that I was, you know, as it went on, I was able to have more childcare. When I was, they were very little, I only had 2 days a week childcare, and my husband was working for Save the Children, so he was flying. I mean, I just look back and think, how did we do it? I suppose we were young, and maybe I was a bit driven, which I don't think of myself as driven, as having something to prove, but
you strike me as somebody who is quite excited by their work, so perhaps that's it, maybe that's what pushed you through it.
Yes, I'm very enthusiastic about it and passionate about what I'm doing, so yes, because I really want to get children reading with as much excitement as I read when I was a kid, and I love a difficult and impossible quest, a bit like Hiccup or Wish. I love an impossible quest, and it is quite an impossible quest, what with libraries closing and, you know, the internet being so wonderful, and so I do love that challenge, and I feel it's very important getting children, you know, because of, yes, and so I suppose all of those things, those do drive me, and yes, and a quest, I suppose I've always, that's maybe, yeah, put your finger on it. That I felt I had a quest. And I think that's another thing that is so lovely about working in the children's book world, is that there are so many people who do feel like they're on that quest. And I'm quite an idealistic person. I love that. I love being surrounded by people who are passionate, whether they're, you know, booksellers or librarians or teachers or fellow authors or publishers. You know, it feels like we're all fighting kind of against uphill odds to get all children reading, you know, to get the magic of, because it just, we know what an advantage reading for the joy of it gives a kid. And I just feel passionately that should be for all children, not just for some children, because everybody should have the same chance in life. And yes, and it's lovely to be part of a whole community that cares about that and is fighting to do this. And so that's also part of it. It's being part of a team.
Yeah, and I want to talk in a moment about the about your role as Children's Laureate and your charter and all of that. Let's just talk before that a little bit about the How to Train Your Dragon series. So
yes,
you wrote 12 books in the How to Train Your Dragon series. You've sold over 11 million copies in 38 languages. Wow. And it's been made into films and a TV series by DreamWorks. I've actually taken my nephew to see some of those films. What is it like to write a story that then takes flight? That wasn't supposed to be a dragon pun, by the way. But it sort of takes flight like that and has another 20 lives after it's left you. What does that feel like?
It's been such a positive experience for me, because I love those films, and I was very close to the filmmakers, and I'm trying to write books that make you laugh and make you cry and make you think and make you sort of think about what it takes to be a hero, what is a real hero, what kind of qualities does a real hero have, and looking after the environment. And it had everything. The movies had all of those themes, even though it departed from the storyline of the books, because there are 12 books and only 3 movies, and I was never writing them intending them to be made into movies, so they're quite booky sort of books, what with the Dragonese language and all of those kind of things. So but the themes, the heart of what I'm trying to do really is there in those movies. As I say, it's quite rare to have films that really work for adults and have a heart to them and can make you cry. I mean, I cry buckets. That's a good movie. It's incredibly rare to have that experience of being lucky enough for that to happen. I don't think I could ever imagine that was going to happen. I mean, we had, 3 Oscar all 3 films were Oscar nominated.
It's incredible.
It's astonishing. So I certainly didn't set out to do that. And it took a very long time. That's the other thing. I think they were first interested in 2004, and the first movie came out 6 years later in 2010. So it was a long old thing, and for a lot of the time I was just thinking, oh, this is never going to happen. But I always loved talking to them because they were so passionate about it, and they cared about the things that I cared about, and they wanted to make this wow feeling of looking at the natural world and what are our responsibilities to it. So, I mean, I really felt very close to them. I'm still very close to, and Dean, the director who directed Lilo and Stitch, and as well, and Bonnie Arnold, who's the producer who produced Toy Story 1. Working with people like that, it was an unexpected gift. I mean, you're never going to think that's going to happen.
No.
If something's very personal to you, which it is, because I suppose, as I was saying earlier on, I think you have to put something of yourself into things. You have to be quite, I think anyway, you have to be honest about your emotions as well. So I put a lot of my feelings about my father into How to Train Your Dragon and being a parent, because it should really have been how to train your baby or how to train your parent, because I was being a parent, and so I was thinking about how I was parented or when I was writing those books. So it's very personal, and having a film made out of something on such a huge scale of something is very personal to you, is quite a strange feeling, and you have to be quite very generous. I think you either have to say, no, I'm not going to let this happen, or you have to understand you're almost giving it to somebody else to as a gift and trusting them to make something wonderful out of it.
Yes.
That is
basically what I was going to ask, because I wondered whether it still feels like your story, because I can imagine, when you write a book, you're taking something personal from your heart and you're putting it on the page and giving it to people. And it's quite a sort of, you know, I think writers early in their career can find that quite exposing. It is very personal and quite an intimate thing to write a story for somebody and hand it over. And so then for a whole team of hundreds of other people to come on board and turn it into something else again, I think what you say about having to be generous, that probably, you know, hits the nail on the head. It's a sharing act rather than you having possession over it anymore.
Control. You can't have control. I think what I felt going into it, I went into it quite open-eyed. I think you're absolutely right, Hattie, is that you can't have control. And actually, that's partly what it is. With a book, you do have so much control. You know, I'm the writer, I'm the illustrator, I'm the set designer. I was saying earlier on, like, I'm like that little kid from years and years ago. I'm designing the costumes, I'm being the actors, I'm acting it out in my writing shed, I'm doing the dialogue. A film just isn't that process. You know, I'm writing the songs. You know, with the movies, it's, you know, you have the director, you have the performances of the actors, you have the producer, you have the wonderful God, in my case, John Powell, doing the music. He was so wonderful. What a great guy as well. Anyway, but all of these things have to come together and they have to find the money to do it, like millions and millions of dollars. So how all of this comes together in a sort of magical, it's a kind of magic that when it works.
Yeah.
And so I think you have to know what you're getting into, because it's a risk. It's a massive risk. And you can, and certainly I said no to kind of television sort of projects or that I thought weren't going to work with, you know, pre DreamWorks coming along. And I can't remember who. Yeah. Anyway, I said no to things who I didn't think got it. But even when you take, you know, you give it to somebody wonderful and you can sense that they really have a sense of what it is and they want to make something wonderful out of it, still it's a risk.
Yes.
Because all of these things have to come together, whereas in a book you are so much more in control.
Yes. Fascinating. Wonderful to have both experiences anyway.
Yeah. But I could see how, I mean, I have been very, very lucky that the end result was wonderful, because it would be heartbreaking to have something that was so personal then not be wonderful.
Yes.
But the thing is, you always have the books, and the books are complete in themselves. I think that's what I went into it thinking. You know, the books aren't like a sort of inferior version, or, you know, the books are what I was writing. So I felt like the films were something different, and if they made something wonderful out of it, great. But
nothing would take away from the books that you had already written.
The books
written.
Are my vision. Yeah. I'm a booky person. I'm a words, you know, person. So I didn't, I felt it was worth taking a risk, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah. So you became the Children's Laureate in 2019.
Yes, it was lovely. I was really touched to be, and sort of proud to be asked, because it's a big honour.
It's a huge honour.
Yeah.
But is it also a responsibility? Do you see it as a responsibility?
Yes, I really do. And for me, we talked about this, that the whole thing about the quest and about getting every child reading, that's so much hardwired into what I'm doing in my writing and what I'm trying to do in my artistic process, which, I mean, it's partly the age group that I'm writing for. If you're writing, actually, teens, you're still trying to get them reading, aren't you? Actually, oh my goodness, actually, that's possibly even harder. But it's so much for children and young adults and teenagers. It's so much part of the process that, you know, as a children's laureate, you're in a great position to try and do that side of it, not just in the way that you write, but in the campaigns that you're doing. So I was very excited about taking on that responsibility. And actually, I've been doing quite a lot of it anyway, because of it. It happens to be an interest of mine and one of my big passions. And so I've been working. I was already on the board, a trustee of World Book Day, and I've been working as an ambassador for the National Literacy Trust for years. So it was sort of a continuation of what I was doing already, but it's great to have that laureate medal so you can go out there and do the campaigns and get a bit more publicity for them and that sort of thing. But I like that kind of thing. I love the performing and that's hard for a lot of writers. I think I've got a big, I'm lucky in that way, because just because you can be a fantastic writer, but be actually really rather a shy person. And I think it's harder nowadays, to if you are that shy person, but a magnificent writer, because there's a lot of performing that goes on that certainly I'm doing and a lot of children's book authors are doing all the time. It's a big part of the job that I think wasn't there 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah. You unveiled a charter when you became Children's Laureate. Is that something that every laureate does, or was that a decision you made that you wanted to have a charter?
Yes. No, that wasn't something I wanted to have a charter. It's like a big to-do list.
Yes. And what was really, I mean, I know there are 10 points on the charter, but what were some of the most important ones for you? What did you really want to achieve with it?
Well, the first one is the reading for the joy of it. And that's almost the heart of everything, because we've known from, worldwide studies for 20 years, over 20 years, we've known that reading for the joy of it, the two key factors in a kid's later economic success, let alone their happiness or anything like that, are one of whom, which is parental involvement in education, and the second one is reading for the joy of it, not because the school tells you to or because for the joy of it. And a kid who does that is likely to do better economically, irrespective of their social background, which should be a joyful statistic, because it means that wherever you come from, if you read for the joy of it, you can get all these benefits, such as, it's all related to owning your own home and voting and not being in prison and all of these things, lovely things, go up with your literacy levels improving. But the problem is all these things that get in the way, so number one is reading for the joy of it, because I think there's a lot of emphasis on the the mechanics of reading, and that's important. Of course, that's important. You have to learn that. But reading for the joy of it is the really important thing, from which all these benefits accrue. So that's a complicated task nowadays, when you've got amazing telly and amazing internet and libraries that libraries declining, and so a lot of the points are sort of a lot of the points are it's a big to-do list, because it's all the areas in which I wanted to be active as laureate, because I think I'm a big believer in magic. Reading is magic, and magic is for everyone, but magic has to be practical as well. so I wanted to give and the practical points are all around really what it takes to make a kid reading for the joy of it. And it's not quite as simple as just teaching them how to read. It's all of those things. So they need to see themselves reflected in a book. We need more diverse books with more diverse, so that every child can look at, find some books where they say, oh, there's a character like me, or that I'm reflected in that. So that's one of the points on it. and every child has the right to see an author event at least once, because we all know how an author going into a school can really excite a child into trying to read for the joy of it. You know, that can be a big, we've seen again the stats on the effect of having authors going into schools. So all of them are, and the library, the library one is a big one on that charter, because it's a really big problem. One in five schools, oh no, one in eight schools don't have a library.
Mm.
But that's self-reported. So the figure is probably higher than that, and it's definitely higher than that for primary schools, and that's a real problem, because you know if your parents can't afford books and your primary school doesn't have a library, how on earth are you supposed to become a reader for the joy of it?
Yes.
So that's what that charter is. It's trying to kind of put down all of the things that could we need to act on to have a nation of readers, of children who all have the same chance in life, which I think every child should have the same chance.
I think it's amazing, Cressida. What a wonderful mission, what a wonderful quest you're on.
Yeah.
But I wonder if as a sort of helpful pointer, we're nearing the end of the interview, but for any writers listening to this, can you think of something that you've learned over the years that has improved your writing?
Oh, there's so many things that I found helpful. I suppose research, I find research really helpful for giving me ideas, even though I'm writing fantasy, and that's been very transformative for me. I think things like, for this is me personally, I suppose learning to not be afraid of being emotional. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it was how I was brought up, or sometimes I was afraid to let go and be emotional and almost not make a fool of yourself, but open yourself up. And of course, you talked about this, Hattie, earlier on. Of course, you're making yourself vulnerable by doing that. And I think I've learnt to do that better over the years, because at the end, you know, not everybody is going to love what you write, and it's better to write something, I think, that is moving and that resonates for some people, that you just put your heart out there, and others are just going to think is a bit silly, or not take it seriously because it's humorous as well as trying to say something more serious, you know. So not to worry about those kind of things is something I suppose I've learned over the years. But I suppose maybe that's just something I'd like to tell myself when I was starting out.
Yes.
Because you are always going to get people, you know, you are putting yourself out there, and you're always going to get people who don't like what you write and who say, you know, oh, you use far too many, I can't remember what I use far too many of, but I use far too many adverbs, or I can't remember. I don't write in a lean way. You're not going to please everybody. You just have to go for it.
Mm.
And I'd rather fail in flames than be a bit so what. I think maybe that's what it is. That's what I've learned anyway. That and if you've never, don't be afraid of making mistakes. You know, there's lovely, isn't it, Einstein who said something like that. Anybody, you know, you've got to be able to make mistakes, you know, and not be afraid of that. of going out into unknown territory and making a bit of a fool of yourself. because you know, yeah, you only got one life.
Yes. And what are you looking at your writing specifically, or looking back at your writing life, what do you feel the most proud of?
Oh, but hang on, but this, I can't choose between my books, because it's like choosing between my children. I am proud that I've written books that are meaning something for children. It's hard to just pick out just one. I think I'm proud. I think I'm still learning, still developing, still getting better. That's what I think anyway. But the, you know, the Emily Brown and the How to Train Your Dragon and the Wizards of Once, I am really proud of them. Although they're not perfect. They're not perfect. You see, you have to be able to let things go, even if they're not perfect. They'll never be perfect. But you can be very ambitious with children as long as you don't bore them. That's what I mean.
That was Cressida Cowell, and thank you so much to her for that chat. If you're wondering, I can confirm that it was, in fact, George Bernard Shaw, the writer of Pygmalion, who had a revolving writing shed. And I've looked it up, and when we're not in lockdown, you can actually go and visit that writing shed. His home is known as Shaw's Corner. It's a National Trust property, and it's in Hertfordshire. Do buy one of Cressida's brilliant books for a child near you. The fourth The Wizards of Once book, Never and Forever, comes out in paperback in May, and you can pre-order it now. You can find some of her titles in my shop on bookshop.org, alongside books by other guests of the podcast. It's at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, which I will put in the show notes as well. I get 10% commission on those sales, so by purchasing from my shop, you help me to make more episodes of the podcast. But more importantly, 10% goes into a pot to support booksellers. This week, bookshop.org passed the threshold of having raised £1 million for independent bookshops, so a huge round of applause to them. If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate and review it, or tell someone about it, or stick it on social media, or just keep listening and don't tell anyone if you want to. I don't mind. I'm just very happy that you're there. Thank you for listening, and see you with another writer next week.